Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 20th of April, and it is time for all things political. Phil Mattingly is our guest this hour, national political correspondent who covers politics and the policies behind the 2016 presidential campaign. He covers it for Bloomberg Politics and Bloomberg Television. Hillary Clinton's first visit to Iowa striking a populist tone. How about these quotes? There's something wrong when hedge fund managers pay less in taxes than nurses or the truckers that I saw on I-80. She may also be bringing on one of Wall Street's fiercest critics to oversee her campaign finances. Will this help ease progressive worries that she is too close to those at the top of the economic ladder? The Washington Post is reporting that New Hampshire could be make or break for Jeb Bush. James Carville says if Jeb Bush loses New Hampshire, they'll get Mitt Romney back in the race. Stories over the weekend indicate the Republican campaign to repeal the Affordable Care Act is essentially over. What are the plans to preserve the subsidies if the Supreme Court backs the challenge to the ACA and the Time Warner Comcast merger might be in trouble? Few of the issues that I'll be bringing to the table this hour, and feel free to bring your own issues. Our phone number for all things political is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can also find us on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Hi, Phil. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Well, let's start with Hillary Clinton, who drove that car all the way from New York to Iowa and saw those hedge fund managers making or paying less in taxes than the nurses or the truckers she saw on I-80, a decidedly populist kind of image that she is presenting. Is she going to carry this through the whole cycle?
A bit of a shift in tone from the former New York senator, that's for sure. Yeah, look, everybody we've talked to or that I've spoken to on her team or around her team say, yeah, this is the message that she's going to try and put out there. Their campaign uses the term everyday Americans. No one's quite sure what that actually means, but that's what they want to talk about and hammer over and over and over again. Now, Kathleen, when it comes to specific policy proposals, you mentioned talking about hedge funds, and you mentioned she also mentioned talking about campaign finance, another populist issue that really resonates well with the Democratic base. We're probably not going to see details fleshed out for a couple more months, but expect the top line talking points really to remain the same when she hits New Hampshire this today already and then in the weeks ahead.
And this idea that she is too cozy with Wall Street that has some Democrats concerned, can she change the image so she's not thought of as a woman who's been quite privileged?
You know, I think the issue that we'll always maintain is the fact that she's going to be raising money in huge, huge sums. And a lot of that money will be coming from Democrats involved in Wall Street, from Democrats that work at hedge funds, which has a very large Democrat constituency. I think the effort that you're seeing on the ground right now is to try and separate the fundraising apparatus, the paid speeches over the last couple of years, and instead make her an on-the-ground, face-to-face campaigner. Don't take any of these early states for granted. Don't take voters for granted. And actually get on the ground and work and hope that, at least in the voters' eyes, maybe they separate the $2-plus billion campaign apparatus from the candidate itself. If that's going to work, I think it's a really big question, but they are certainly going all in on that strategy right now, at least early.
It seems to me as though that's a difficult strategy, Phil, that if you're raising $2.5 billion, the most expensive race in the history of races, and you're calling for campaign finance reform at the same time, that there's rather a disconnect, isn't there?
Yeah, I think a lot of us are trying to figure out where she's going with this specifically. And she hasn't, as I said earlier, she hasn't laid out a specific policy proposal as to what this would entail. You can be very cagey with your language here when you're talking about campaign finance and what was allowed by the Citizens United case in 2010 by the Supreme Court. Look, she's going to have dark money groups, these 501c4s, these not super PACs, actual dark money groups that will support her. Period. They are going to come out. Now, she won't take ownership of them, but she's certainly not going to tell them not to spend. And so with that in mind, her ability to push perhaps a constitutional amendment banning entities like that seems to be a bit of a stretch, but I think the refrain you always hear from Democrats when you talk about this issue is, look, we're not going to unilaterally disarm. This is what Republicans are doing, so we have to do the same thing. Whether or not that actually resonates with voters, I think, is a big question. This is an issue in terms of campaign finance that voters love, particularly in the Democratic base. We also saw Chris Christie talking about it in New Hampshire last week. This is one that resonates, that really hits. But the simple fact of the matter is as long as the current system maintains, you're not going to see candidates take any other course than what they've been taking as it's gotten progressively larger over the last couple cycles.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering how she will use, we were talking before we went on the air about former President Bill Clinton, who was speaking at the memorial for Oklahoma City bombing victims mm-hmm. yesterday, and how masterful he is at really connecting, saying he was looking at his granddaughter's face before he came to Oklahoma so he could connect with the people who lost children at that horrible day. There's something about his incredible ability to do that that she doesn't have, and it would seem to me that it would behoove her campaign well to use him to make the very connection with voters that she's trying to make.
There's nobody better, and her team would be the first to admit that. I think that there's a lot of wariness is probably strong, but I think caution into, in 2008, with some of the comments he made about President Obama and his campaign, he ended up getting the campaign into some trouble, into some very bad news cycles. So I think there's some caution in how they want to deploy him. They want to make sure that the campaign message is driven entirely by the candidate, by the campaign that she wants to run before Bill Clinton really kind of springs into action. But there's no doubt about it. He is an extraordinarily valuable asset. You have to figure out a way to use him on the trail, as President Obama did in 2012, or as Democrats tried to do during the midterms in 2014. I do think, and I have heard, that it's going to be a while before you see him kind of really released to go to work. But as you said, there's just no way you keep him on the bench. He's too talented an individual to keep on the bench, and at some point they're going to have to let him go and let him do what he does best.
Well, it's going to be a while before we have an election, right?
This is true, yeah. Unfortunately, we're a long way away.
I know. Phil, do you see her having any serious challenge among other Democrats?
You know, we've all been searching for it in the media. I think it would probably make for, to be completely honest, it would make for a much more interesting next couple of months if there was one. The one that we've all been hearing in the early states in Iowa and New Hampshire lately is Martin O'Malley, the former governor of Maryland, really does well in small crowds, connecting with liberal-based Democratic voters. He's done well in his swings there the last couple of weeks. When you touch down on the ground there and you talk to people who have encountered him, they like him, they like his message, it's very progressive. There's no concerns about his ties to Wall Street, as we were talking about earlier with Hillary Clinton. But the simple fact is, you look at the latest CNN ORC poll, he's logging 1%, and that mm-hmm. it just hasn't changed. He hasn't gotten a big boost in the last couple of weeks, even though he's been there regularly. And so, obviously Joe Biden's a big wild card. He's getting 10 or 11% in most polls. Maybe he could mount something, particularly if he thinks Hillary's vulnerable. But right now, I mean, she's got 68-69%. There's just nobody who can kind of rally the resources, the infrastructure, the Democratic Party in general, like Hillary Clinton can. It's tough to see somebody make major headway anytime in the near future.
Let's go to New Hampshire and Jeb Bush. The Washington Post reporting over the weekend that it could be make or break. And James Carville saying, which I thought is interesting, I wonder if you agree, if Jeb Bush loses New Hampshire, they'll get Mitt Romney back in the race, do you think?
He said this a couple times, and you always wonder with James Carville if he knows something you don't, or if he's just trying to stir some stuff
right
up. A lot of people paid attention when Mitt Romney chose not to run, that he didn't explicitly say he was completely out of the race. He left some, and I forget the wording, but it was vague enough for people to say, maybe if there was an opening, he would come back in. Look, the Republican bench right now, the Republican field right now, just in declared candidates, let alone another six or seven that should declare over the next couple weeks, is deep, and it's talented, and it's not like it was in 2011 or 2012. There are any number of candidates who can very, very well have an opportunity to win in a general election if they make it through the primary. I don't think you're going to see a situation where Marco Rubio flames out, Rand Paul flames out, Ted Cruz flames out, and Jeb Bush all flame out at the same time. the one thing that you could look for if you are even entertaining the possibility that Mitt Romney would get back in, his circle of donors, his pathway to a victory in that field would be for Chris Christie, Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio possibly, and Scott Walker all to go up in flames. Mm. And then that establishment credibility, that establishment money would be searching for somebody, and maybe then Mitt Romney comes in, but I just don't. It's tough. It's a deep field right now, and a lot of donors are already committed, and so it would be tough to see that pathway forward.
Well, because we're in Wisconsin and we've never spoken with you before, I'm interested in your thoughts about Governor Scott Walker and where he is nationally. A Marquette University poll came out last week showing his popularity dropping here in the state of Wisconsin. A, where does he stand in the field? And B, does that make any difference how popular you are at home once you've achieved national prominence?
You know, I'm not sure that it does, because right now he's running for a primary victory. He's not running to win in general. And as he's ranked, as he's worked over the last couple of months, he got a lot of buzz in Iowa early on. I think we all saw his rise. He's been a little bit quiet compared to where he was, and I think some of that has to do with the fact that he and his team felt a little bit burned by some of the questions he was getting, a little bit burned perhaps more honestly by some of the answers he gave to some of those questions. But nationally, he's still considered, to any Republican operative or fundraiser you talk to, in the top tier of candidates. He's still polling second to Jeb Bush in national polls. He's still polling well in the early states. I think everybody you talk to thinks he's a real deal, or he is the real deal. I think when you talk to Republicans that are going up against him, they think that if he's given enough time in the public eye, he will do enough to damage himself that he won't have an impact on the race. As of now, though, that just hasn't happened. He's still polling well. He's got money. He's going to form a super, or his allies are going to form a super PAC soon. He's real. He's very much so considered real right now in this race.
And I would imagine that one of the things people like about him, I'll ask you the other things, what they like about him in the party, is that he does have a kind of a populist image, this talk about buying his clothes at Kohl's, and he is coming off as a regular guy who doesn't, and he doesn't, have a lot of wealth personally.
Right, the $1 sweater at Kohl's,
right,
is the go-to line. I think in New Hampshire this past weekend, he pulled out that he'd just gotten a suit from Joseph A. Bank, which, if it was anything like the Joseph A. Bank deals that I've seen, he probably got 16 other ones just for the cost of that one. It's a combination of things that I think works really well, and that is he's the normal guy, but also he's got a record, and he's got a record on policy issues that the Republican Party gravitates to, particularly in a primary race. He can point to it over and over again. He has done substantive things in a what is generally considered to be a purple state, certainly not a hotbed of conservatism, and he's accomplished things. And I think when you hold that up against a president that the party is obviously very much against and doesn't believe has the vision that they do, and some of his potential competitors in the race, that sets him apart. And I think that is what has attracted donors and kind of early state supporters up to this point. I think the big question with him is, if you keep putting him on the public stage, is he going to perform? Is his stumps, when he gets away from the stump speech and has to answer questions from people in New Hampshire, is he going to perform? I think his team is very confident in that. But I think, as I mentioned earlier, some competitors think that there's going to be some holes there. That's what will be most interesting to see.
Phil Mattingly is our guest for All Things Political today. He covers the White House for Bloomberg Politics and Bloomberg Television. He has covered economics, finance, lobbying, political campaigns, the Justice Department, and he is with us for the full hour. He was also closely covering the 2012 presidential, 2014, and 2010 midterm campaigns. He's an award-winning journalist, covers Congress, economics, and financial policy, the Justice Department, and also Washington's lobbying industry. Well, so far we've talked about a few of the people who are running for president. We have other issues we'll be discussing with him. I want to get to the Affordable Care Act. The Supreme Court will soon be issuing an opinion whether or not they back the challenge to the ACA. Some newspapers having some interesting reports over the weekend that the Republican campaign to repeal the Affordable Care Act is essentially over. There are a couple presidential candidates some who have not officially announced that they would like to repeal that. But more and more you're seeing the Republicans come up with their own plan, which is very similar to the Affordable Care Act. We'll ask what the plans are, what will happen with the subsidies if the Supreme Court backs the challenge to the ACA. Time Warner, Comcast merger might be in trouble. It would be a very, very big merger, one of the biggest deals we've ever seen in telecom and the media. How it will fare will have huge implications for the way that we get online and also watch television. But that $45 billion merger is in a little bit of trouble. The Justice Department evidently not crazy about this idea, so we will talk about that and whatever else he would like to discuss. Our number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin. Wisconsin Public Radio. All things political this hour, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We start with Tommy in Nina. Hi, Tommy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Go right ahead, sir.
I was calling about Hillary Clinton and if she was elected for president, how you guys felt about her stance on abortion.
Phil?
I think that one of the key issues, and I think one of the main things that was left in the air based on the 2008 campaign from Hillary Clinton when it came to social issues was her view on gay marriage, which I think this last week was a bit of some news, one of the few issues of news on the policy side, where her campaign was willing to acknowledge that she has more or less evolved to the point of where President Obama is, hopes that the Supreme Court strikes down any state-based bans on gay marriage. When it comes to other social issues, abortion included, there's not a lot of divergence between the current the person who currently inhabits the White House and what Hillary Clinton would bring to the table when she gets there. I think in the Democratic Party, if there's been one thing they've been able to do that Republicans have not been able to do, it's coalesce around social issues in a way that there's just not much of a shift between any candidate. And I think that's a change from 2008. But now more and more on the abortion issue, on gay rights, on all of these issues, you've seen them kind of align almost in a straight line, which I think is very different than what we've seen from the Republican Party.
Let's talk about health care in the Republican Party. There were some interesting stories, Phil, over the weekend that essentially the Republican campaign, which has been strong and steady to repeal the Affordable Care Act, is pretty much over. The Republicans have a plan that's very similar to the Democratic plan. Is it pretty much over?
You know, look, I think this is more reality-based on Capitol Hill than it is a policy-based. There is a recognition that as the governing majority, they need to govern. And without 60 votes in the Senate, which they do not currently have, they cannot move, and without themselves in the White House, they're not going to be able to move any type of repeal of Obamacare. And what does that mean? It doesn't mean that they don't want it to be repealed, and I think you'll hear it over and over again on the campaign trail when you're talking about the presidential election. And I've already gotten emails from Republican staffers who don't appreciate the stories that say that their focus has shifted. But the reality is that the 50-plus times that House Republicans voted to repeal Obamacare, Obamacare remained in place. Now, the biggest issue right now that is on the table is whether or not the Supreme Court is going to strike down the ability for Obamacare to provide subsidies to federal-based exchanges. Now, you mentioned the potential for a Republican plan related to this. There's a simple reason for it, and that's if the Supreme Court strikes down these subsidies, that means 7 million people on these 34 federal-based exchanges would be losing subsidies, would be losing their health care. I think Republicans do recognize that that's a terrible political situation.
Yes.
It's also a very poor policy situation, and they need some kind of alternative. That means they're going to try and coalesce around something. But repeal right now, as you said, has been moved to the back burner.
Mm-hmm. Don't you think that's in the back of the Supreme Court members' minds, too, that millions of people would lose coverage?
You know, it's an interesting question. It's been one we've all been trying to divine when we've seen public statements from the justices over the last couple of months, whether or not we thought that, or whether or not they thought that this would have an impact. And it really, we haven't gotten a clear picture. I think some have said, yes, of course, you read the newspaper, you know what the impact is. But there's also people who say, look, we're going to look specifically at what the law says, and that is our responsibility. If you talk to people inside the Obama administration, there's a lot of concern right now about how this case is going to end up. There is a very, very real possibility that these subsidies get struck down, and that is going to put a lot of weight on the Republican Congress to try and find some type of solution right now, and that's why you're seeing some proposals start to trickle out about refundable tax credits, things of that nature, to try and figure out how to bridge that gap if this actually comes into play.
Isn't the whole thing kind of weird, Phil? Because it's my understanding, complete all of this, if you will, for me.
Sure.
It was based on a few words that were probably not the best words, but the intent of what was supposed to happen with the Affordable Care Act was, of course, to make sure that there were subsidies. It was just poorly written? Is that, this is all based on a few words that were not right?
It's definitely based on a few words. Now, how it actually got to this point depends on who you ask. If you talk to Democrats who are involved in the process, they say that this was purely sloppy legislative activity. This was the idea of when you cram a bunch of bills together and you haven't quite married what Section 1 and Section 15 say, and you end
right.
up with this. The other idea, and I think this is kind of the basis for the case, and this is what Republicans have been pushing who believe in the merits of this case, is that the idea was that this was supposed to be a – the subsidies were supposed to be a carrot that forced states to set up their own exchanges. If the states did not set up their own exchanges, then they would not get the subsidies. That's how they read the law. That's how they read the specific provision, the specific couple words you're talking about right now. Democrats say that's a misreading, that's a misinterpretation of the legislative intent. But these issues are out there, and I think if you read the law just based specifically on what it says, there is a section in the law that says only states can get the subsidies. There's no specific section of the law saying that federal exchanges, the 34 that now exist, should be allowed to have those same exchanges. Where that was cleared up was when it was in an IRS rulemaking. What the court's looking at right now is whether or not to strike the ability of the IRS to make that rulemaking. So, yeah, sloppy legislation certainly
right.
played a role in it one way or the other.
800-486-8655 is our number, and you're listening to All Things Political here on the Ideas Network. Phil Mattingly is our guest, national political correspondent, covers politics and policies behind the 2016 presidential campaign for Bloomberg Politics, and Bloomberg Television is our guest this hour. And let's go next to Paul in Richland Center. Hi, Paul.
Thank you very much. I just have a question for your guest as to when is the national media going to focus on Scott Walker as a candidate in terms of the devastating policies that he's put into effect in Wisconsin. His drop in the polls of 8 points is reflective that some citizens are now expressing buyer's remorse that they may have voted for him the past 3 times. Those polls are not reflecting people like me who have never supported Scott Walker and his policies, but it's people that are finally realizing that the policies that he's enacted are directly now affecting them, and that's why the drop in the polls. His state policies will be his national policies, and for some reason, he has some kind of a charisma that I've never understood, that he comes across, you know, as the everyman common man, and he's anything but that. And I know, you know, he can bamboozle some people, because obviously he's done that in this state, but his a national president as Scott Walker would be devastating to this country. And just on a side note, I'm a Martin O'Malley supporter myself.
All right, Paul, thank you.
That's my question.
Thanks for the call. What do you say, Phil?
You know, I think it's if it hasn't started to a level that is appreciated yet, it's coming in terms of the depth of the media looking into the specific policies. I think if you look back at his governor's race, one of the reasons why he's so attractive to Republicans right now is they feel like he's been tested. He's gone through the rigor of 3 really, really tough races where his policies have been picked apart. They have been messaged against by Democrats. They have been written about by the media, by the Wisconsin media. I think that that digging is just going to continue. And the longer, you know, we saw for a couple weeks there where he became the guy, and now he started to sink back a little bit because I think his advisors thought maybe he got a little bit too far out there and became the targeted one. That will come back as long as he is considered in the top tier of the candidates. I don't think there's any question right now that his policies that he's pursued as governor are going to be similar on a national scale. I think that's part of the appeal, actually, in the primary process for him with Republican voters. But I do think that the national media will be paying very close attention to every single piece of any of these guys' records as it comes closer to election time. I think there's a lot of time left, and I think the people are still trying to figure out where everybody stands, and that's how you decide resources-wise. You know, another interesting point, you mentioned the record and how the home state reacts. Chris Christie's poll numbers in New Jersey have just plummeted.
Have they?
Absolutely plummeted. And it's a similar type of an issue. It's not necessarily that people are upset that he's running that he might run a national campaign. It's that they're not happy with the policies that he's put on the ground. They've seen ratings cuts. They've seen budget issues. So not too unlike what Scott Walker's dealt with back home, that maybe on the ground they have a closer view of the policies and maybe they don't like them.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this because I know Bloomberg reported on this on Friday. Attorneys at the Justice Department's antitrust division making moves that may halt this merger between Comcast and Time Warner Cable. The new company would have 30 million subscribers, and from what I've read, it's one of the biggest deals ever and would have implications for how we watch television, how we get online. What does the Justice Department see as the problem areas?
Well, I think you mentioned the size in and of itself, $45.2 billion deal. There's a lot of concern within the federal government about what this would actually mean. Now, what they've decided to do, you know, Bloomberg reported that there's a lot of concerns of the Justice Department. Also reported that there will be a meeting between the companies and Justice Department officials this week as they start to try and hash out some of the differences that actually exist there. What you see with this Justice Department's antitrust division is this is often a negotiating tactic. This is what they're doing. They're acknowledging their dislike for a potential deal. They might even actually sue to block a particular deal. And often this is something that's done to be able to bring all of the parties in and try and extract concessions that they feel like will be better for consumers. Now, I'm not totally sure that that's what's going on here, but that's what's been going on with this Justice Department's antitrust division for a long period of time. One of the issues that the Justice Department specifically on this deal has taken issue to is Comcast's involvement with the streaming video service Hulu. Now, they were supposed to be a passive investor in this service. There's some concern over the Justice Department that they were actually more involved than they were supposed to be. It's a little bit of an in-the-weeds issue, but it's just one. You have to think of it this way. At a $45 billion deal, if that issue is cropping up, just imagine how many issues actually exist right now. And I think that's what they're trying to hash out right now. Comcast and Time Warner desperately want this deal to go through. It's safe to say there will be some concessions offered during this meeting on Wednesday, and this is far from a done deal. But this is certainly not a problem that they wanted to confront at this stage.
They are huge campaign contributors, aren't they?
The biggest. They're actually.
They are the biggest now?
They're the biggest. Their lobbying presence in D.C. is the biggest. They're bigger than any bank you could think of. One of the more interesting things, and I when this story broke, I was actually on the phone with a Republican source of mine who said, this is of great credit to the Justice Department. And this obviously shook me a little bit because this Republican source was not a huge fan of ever complimenting the Obama administration and certainly not Eric Holder's Justice Department. But his point was that Comcast as a company is very, very close to the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. Some of its top officials are huge fundraisers for the president. They're huge fundraisers for some of the policies. On net neutrality, the Obama administration went against Comcast's position. And on this issue, at least so far, the Justice Department is willing to go against Comcast's position. So obviously, not everything's great when it comes to money and politics, but some, I think, reassurance, at least to this individual who I was speaking to, in the fact that despite all of that, the Justice Department is still looking, at least at this stage, at whether or not this deal is actually good for consumers.
Well, Phil, I think you or somebody from Bloomberg should do a really long investigative piece of where all the money is going that we pay to cable companies, because it's unbelievable.
It really is. I I don't disagree with that.
Yeah, just a lot of money. Our number, 800-486-8655. We're talking about all things political. We've been on a number of different topics. Our guest is very closely covering the 2016 presidential race, which amazingly is in full progress. We're talking about Hillary Clinton. We started the hour talking about her. She's, we have to get to this with him, too. She has hired somebody known as, Phil describes him, with sharp elbows, pushing for tighter regulation of the financial industry to look after her campaign finances. What does that say? We've talked about Jeb Bush a little bit. We've talked about Scott Walker, Martin O'Malley, obviously. There are many other people in the race, Scott Walker, so we can look at all of those people more closely and look at those we have only mentioned but not talked very much about. The Affordable Care Act, do you think that Republicans have pretty much given up on trying to get rid of the Affordable Care Act, or do you imagine it will be more of a campaign issue as the months go on, particularly if the Supreme Court gets rid of the subsidies part of this plan, which could be catastrophic, I think, for the whole program. Time Warner and Comcast, we're talking about that merger and the Justice Department making indications that they've got problems with that merger. Do you have problems with that merger? I want to talk about this horrible humanitarian crisis of people who are trying to get out of Libya and other countries in Africa and drowning at sea in the Mediterranean. These stories are horrible. We're going to talk about it for the full hour on Thursday at 1 o'clock, but I'd like for Phil to at least mention this, that the world seems to have a serious problem with where refugees from war can go and where poor people can go, too. 800-486-8655 is our number, and let's go to Joseph in La Crosse next. Hi, Joseph.
Hi, Kathleen. And first of all, let me tell you that it's been a couple of years that I've been able to listen to your show. I've been in Germany.
Oh.
And so I'm very excited to hear you again and be back speaking with you. Thank you,
Joseph. Welcome home.
Two things here. One is regarding the whole the merger thing. This is all really, when you get right down to it, this is a bad joke. The reality of what's going on here is pretty much lost on 90% of the population in this country. You take a company like the Dish Network, which is holding on to Spectrum just in the hopes that it will go up in value, and of course it's going to. You look at the Spectrum auctions that are coming up with the TV stations, where the federal government is encouraging the television stations to sell it. It's going to be worth billions, but they're selling something that the public owns for personal profits. And the deals between the businesses, and when he was talking about, you know, the Justice Department's involvement here, this is like what happens in criminal cases, right? 98% of all criminal cases get settled without any kind of a trial. Same thing happens now in business deals. They get a little bit of what they want. We fine a company for doing something, but they admit to no wrongdoing. We've become a nation of negotiators, and no one ever pays an actual penalty for wrongdoing. You know, you go into AT&T, there's 272 plans. Imagine being 85 years old, getting your first smartphone, and there's 272 plans in just one company, and our prices are off the charts. And like you said, what do we get for all the money we pay for cable? And that was one thing. And my other thing was, I'm interested in his comments on the fact that solar and renewables are now being attacked on the state level because the utilities have given up on the idea that the federal government is going to be nice to them. They're going to keep subsidizing solar. They're going to keep subsidizing these installations. So now they're doing an end run through the public utility commissions, and just saying those three words puts most people to sleep, so nobody pays attention to it. But, you know, they recognize that in Germany, where I live now, $40 billion in market capitalization was lost by the utilities over the past 5 years, and they see that coming their way with the advent of solar installations being paid for by the solar company, who then sells the power back to the utilities. So I'm curious where he thinks this is going to head in the United States, because I feel certain they don't want to repeat that mistake.
Thank you very much, Joseph. Phil.
Yeah, the latter question is actually a great question. I admittedly am not super well-versed in it. I think when you look at what's been one of the more interesting dynamics, I think, throughout the time with the White House, with the current White House, with the current president in office, is trying to watch them grapple with just the massive shift in the energy sector in the United States. I think there's been, if you look, if you want to compare it politically, if you look at the politics of the issues of energy that President Barack Obama was facing as a candidate compared to where he is now, they've shifted dramatically just by what the U.S. is capable of producing, but also by entrenched interests that just have no desire to move, even if the belief is that technologically they need to be shifting in a new direction at some point in the near future. So while I admittedly don't have a great answer to the question, I think that just in general, the sector and watching the changes that are forced to happen by the technology, by the advances that are made, versus the changes that are being blocked in every way that they possibly can by entrenched interests, is always a kind of a fascinating battle to watch. Unfortunately, I think it's fair to say federal policymakers probably aren't in the best place to give a green light to one or the other, and probably shouldn't be. However, that's the position that they're currently in, and I think that those are fights that are always very interesting to pay attention to on Capitol Hill.
Thanks very much for the call. As I said, we're going to talk about this on Thursday, but this story is kind of haunting me today, and it indicates that something's really wrong in the world. Not that there aren't many things really wrong, but this refugees fleeing northern Africa to reach Europe. Sunday morning, this small boat capsizing south of an Italian island. 700 people are dead. 700 people. And there were 400 people just a little while ago, just days ago. This is a crisis, an international crisis, isn't it? You can't have all these people dying in the Mediterranean because they're trying to escape war and they're trying to escape poverty. Oh, my gosh, it's horrible.
I think the apathy just in general from European leaders up to this point, and you hope maybe this is what sparks a shift. But I think when you talk to U.S. officials, just in kind of checking throughout the day, yesterday and today about this, they're stunned when you look. This is forcing people to pay a close attention to this issue, and you recognize that this isn't a one-off. This isn't the first time this has happened. This is something that's right. been happening on a regular basis. And the unwillingness of the European Union nations to be actually come in and try and do something about this, I think is it's really disturbing to U.S. officials, and I think just in general, when you read about it, it's really disturbing.
It is.
But I think immigration just in Europe in general is a huge, huge issue, and that isn't likely to be resolved anytime soon. I think the one hope that you have when something like this happens is it sparks the need for change or recognition of the need for change. And I'm not necessarily sure, as dramatically terrible as this is, I don't know that it has that impact. Mm. I really don't. And that's kind of a stunning statement to make, but mm-hmm. I don't. It's that much of an issue over there.
Phil Mattingly is our guest for All Things Political this April 20th. He covers the White House for Bloomberg Politics and Bloomberg Television, and he is covering the 2016 presidential race. He has covered the Justice Department. He covered the midterms 2010, the presidential race in 2012, and has won many awards for his work. We're welcoming phone calls. Our lines are busy at the moment, but just keep trying and you'll get through. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can also find us on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls for All Things Political. Fred in Wisconsin Rapids is next. Hello, Fred.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
I wanted to say I think Scott Walker is too polarizing a figure to ever be the Republican presidential candidate. He has strong Koch brother support. What I think is a more likely scenario would be if somebody like a moderate, like Jeb Bush, gets the presidential nod, that Walker would be the VP, and there he would pull in the Tea Party and the very extreme conservative vote of the Republican Party, and then there'd be the chance to that they could swing Wisconsin into the Republican camp. Whereas it's a purple state right now. So that's basically my comments.
Thank you very much, Fred, for your call. Phil?
Yeah, no, that's taking it. It's sharp political strategist that's taken it a couple steps further than we are right now. No, I think, you know, one of the things that's going to be really interesting over the next couple months is as the Republican field kind of shakes itself out a little bit is you look at it as in camps. You look at establishment Republicans versus Tea Party-esque Republicans, if you will. Establishment Republicans are traditionally the pick to win the nomination. That hasn't worked well over the last two campaign cycles, and so you have a lot of strong conservatives, a lot of Tea Party-backed conservatives saying, let's try something else. Let's try a Ted Cruz. Let's try a Rand Paul. We have to do something differently because our quote-unquote establishment candidates have lost by large margins for the most part to Democrats. How that plays out is going to be really interesting. I think one of the big questions establishment Republicans have is about the electability in a general election of somebody like Ted Cruz. While that his issues, his policies may absolutely resonate and hit in a big way in conservative states, in conservative primaries, will they resonate and hit in a big way in swing states like Ohio or Florida or things like that? And I think so. How that actually plays out is going to be very interesting. We want to get into vice presidential candidate picks. That's always one of the more fun things to pay attention to, as you look and see what people are, what demographics are, is the presidential candidate trying to hit with a specific pick. And Scott Walker trying to flip Wisconsin, that might be really interesting. Although based on our conversation today,
right,
maybe
not
want him to win Wisconsin statewide,
right,
based on his current numbers.
Yeah. Let's go back to, let me ask a general question, but I think that your response is going to be interesting. You wrote a piece some time ago, and I want you to talk about Clinton and her, I don't know if she's hired Gary Gensler or not, this former top federal financial regulator, mm-hmm, and strong advocate for strict Wall Street rules, but we'll get to him after we get to this. It seems like it was forever ago, but it wasn't that long ago that the Democrats had a sweeping defeat in the midterm elections. The Republicans, during their sweeping defeat in the last presidential election, were asking, what do we need to do to get people to vote Republican? What about the Hispanic vote, the Latino vote in this country? Can we attract more minority voters? Do we need to in order to win the presidency? You've spent some time talking about the direction of the Democratic Party, and I'm wondering, do you think that the Republicans have defined what their voice is going to be in this big presidential election, and have the Democrats defined what their vision is?
I think to your first question, no. And I think that's what makes the current campaign so fascinating on the Republican side, is this is really a fight. Look, in 2012, Mitt Romney had 10 times the money of anybody. He was always expected to be the nominee. Yes, he lost a couple primaries. Yes, it went a lot longer than he wanted it to because of Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich and a few others. But it was always going to be Mitt Romney. This is wide open. This is a wide open field on the Republican side, which means that it will really be up to the primary voters to decide the direction of the Republican Party in the 2016 campaign. That could be a direction that includes zero concessions on immigration. It could be an area that is just running completely against anything we've seen over the last 6 or 7 years. Or it could be somebody more establishment-based, like Jeb Bush, who believes in immigration reform or is willing to talk about Common Core, things of that nature. And so, no, there's no unified path forward for the Republican Party, and I think that's what's so interesting. How this shakes out is really going to mean something for generations to come. On the Democratic side, as of now, it only looks like you have one candidate. So I think when it comes to trying to win an election, I think what Democrats are looking to, you know, if you look at the midterms versus a national election like we're going to have in 2016, it's can they get the Obama coalition to come back out again? And I think that's what you talk to Hillary's people right now, and that's what they're trying to figure out how to do.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if they do. Did she take on this Gary Gensler to be looking after her campaign's finances?
Yes.
She did.
Yes. Well, it hasn't officially been announced yet, but it is officially a done deal. And I think when you look at it, you know, what was the first thing we talked about today? Is Hillary Clinton too close to Wall Street?
Right.
Well, this, Gary Gensler worked for a very small agency called the Commodity Futures Trading Commission with very, very big responsibilities under the new financial reform law, overseeing the $700 trillion derivatives market, swaps market. Now, what is that? That's the instruments that were blamed at least in part for fueling the 2000 2008 financial crisis. He's a very, very strong proponent of regulation to the point where he actually frustrated people in the Obama administration because he was trying to get too strict with the rules in the past. So this definitely checks that box. But another thing to keep an eye on with Gary Gensler is he was running a very small agency that was having its budgets cut on a regular basis. He's going to be responsible for overseeing, as we talked about earlier, a $2 billion campaign. Somebody who knows how to make money go a long way and can stand up and be, as we mentioned earlier, a guy with sharp elbows who will stand up and say what's actually going on is something they did not have in the 2007-2008 campaign, and a role that he is expected to play as CFO of her campaign.
Mm. Thanks for doing that reporting on that. I'll follow him more closely now. Troy in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Troy.
Hello. I just had a comment. I was curious. Obviously, I'm from Wisconsin. And, you know, to anyone who's looking at all, Scott Walker is certainly running for president. I've always been interested in campaign finance and particularly finance reform. And so I'm wondering, when exactly does someone have to officially declare that they're running so that they have to abide by campaign, you know, financing limits and stuff like that? Whereas right now he can just take all the donations he wants, right?
So it's one of the worst games that people play, and it's one of those that we probably don't do as good a job paying a close enough attention to because we all get that it's all being done with a wink and a nod. It's why Jeb Bush and Scott Walker will all say that they're just considering, even though they've hired a ton of staff. They've got campaign organizations basically in waiting, infrastructure being set up, digital teams being set up. All of this is being done through their political action committees. Scott Walker's allies are now starting a super PAC to support him as well. Basically, so long as Scott Walker does not declare himself a candidate, he can essentially do all of this type stuff because of the ambiguity of Federal Election Commission rules. And the Federal Election Commission is not known as a very aggressive regulator when it comes to trying to pursue these issues. There's actually been complaints filed by good government groups saying that this is ridiculous that these candidates are able to do this. However, this is the way it's done now. You set up the infrastructure before having to commit. It gives you an ability to go raise money for groups like super PACs, which eventually a wall will be erected and you can't go talk to people from the super PACs. So it gives them a lot of flexibility to raise, as your point is made, without having to make any commitments. But yes, he's obviously got a campaign. It's all in waiting,
sure,
as is Jeb Bush's. But this is the way around it right now, and this is campaign finance in a nutshell. It's basically how can the lawyers find ways around things to benefit their candidates, and there are dozens and dozens of loopholes like this.
Mm-hmm. Jim in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I went to Nashville this week, and while I was there, I was reading a book by Frank Luns, a conservative writer, on words at work. But the reason they work is because people don't think very well. For example, Luns said that people will buy the idea if you say it's common sense that we should fight ISIS overseas so that we don't have to fight them at home. But the flip side of that is that if you that common sense tells us that empires fall because they overextend themselves, and common sense tells us that the people I'm blocking. Common sense tells us that you can't, if you stop messing with people overseas, they wouldn't want to mess with you at home. The other thing I got out of the Nashville trip was that I went to the Country Hall of Fame, and back in the 60s, Big Ernie Ford was talking about how the coal miner couldn't go to St. Peter because he owed his soul to the company store. And the current young singers in at the Opry said that he wanted to buy a truck, and he wanted to be rich, and he wanted to buy a boat. And none of this indicated, and also he bragged that he was a Christian, but he didn't say that you try to get rich because you want to help people and observe the Beatitudes and care about people and protect and respect the great, beautiful land that God has given us and the health of our families. So if people can't or won't think, the future looks very sad indeed.
Phil.
Yeah, no disagreement to the overarching point. I think the interesting part about your first point, Frank Luntz is the messaging guru of the Republican Party. He was actually in New Hampshire watching the candidates today. He has probably coined every kind of the death tax when he was talking about inheritance, tax on inheritance, things of that nature. He has coined all of those terms. So when it comes to knowing how to use language to persuade, there's nobody better, and it's a safe bet that he is advising more than one potential Republican candidate going forward. So always keep an eye on what Frank's doing, because Frank is probably behind a lot of the messages you're hearing right now.
Well, I think you need to keep an ear on what they're singing at the Grand Old Opry.
Also true.
Right, don't you think? Thank you so much, Phil, for being with us. You're a delightful guest, and you sure know your material. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for having me, Kevin.
Yeah, our great pleasure. Our thanks to Phil Mattingly for being with us. He's been covering Congress, economics, financial policy, the Justice Department, Washington's lobbying industry, helped lead Bloomberg News coverage of the federal response to the financial crisis, and he is the national political reporter covering the politics and policies behind the 2016 presidential campaign for Bloomberg Politics and Bloomberg Television. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour. Thanks to Jennifer Dargan in from Madison for doing phones for us this afternoon. News coming up, we'll return.